Welcome to the great debate. This isn't the Lincoln-Douglas debate, though that's not a bad precedent. As noted in an earlier lecture, Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were rival candidates for the Senate from Illinois. In August through October of 1858, they held 7 face-to-face debates in towns across the state. Papers across the country printed those debates in full. The purpose of all debates is to mold opinion. Lincoln knew that. In the very first debate, he says, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. He who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. He makes statutes and decisions possible or impossible." The debate you're about to hear won't rise to the level of Lincoln and Douglas, but I want you to use it to hone your skills in argument analysis, putting to work some of what we've covered. I'll interrupt at various points to ask you to analyze what you've heard. I'm particularly interested in your applying what we've talked about in evaluating parts of the arguments. There's nothing that says this has to be done fast. If you want to pause the debate at any point, to repeat a passage, or to give yourself some time to think, go right ahead. High school and college debate teams use a format named after the Lincoln-Douglas debates. An initial statement by side A is followed by a brief questioning by side B. B's full initial statement is then followed by a brief questioning by A. Each side is then given a chance for rebuttal with an interesting structure: a short rebuttal for A, a longer rebuttal for B, and a short final word for A. I know, it's complicated, and our debate won't follow that strict form. In fact, the Lincoln-Douglas debates did neither, although they did allow equal time for each side in an ABA structure. Douglas spoke first in 4 of the debates. Lincoln spoke first in 3. And now for our great debate. As you listen, I want you to pay attention to the flow of argument. What's the speaker's intended conclusion? What are the reasons given in support of that conclusion? And how precisely are they supposed to support the conclusion? I'll also ask you whether the reasons given really do support the conclusion. Is the argument valid? In another lecture, we've talked about standard forms of bogus arguments, fallacies. I want you to keep a sharp eye open for those. Without further ado, the first debate. The topic, democracy.
It's becoming clearer every day that democracy is the wave of the future. What we have witnessed is the increasing democratization of the world. The Arab Spring is only one of the more recent signs. Dictatorships are falling, monarchies and hereditary aristocracies and oligarchies are tumbling. There's a scent of freedom in the air, power to the people. That's the stirring cry of human progress. That's the sound of democracy on the march. But don't take my word for it. Here's some hard data from Freedom House, an international organization that conducts research on the topic. Freedom House categorizes countries as either free, partly free, or not free. If you look at their data, you'll see that the percentage of free countries in the world has risen approximately 20% over the last 35 years. And we can project that trend into the future. By 2045, over 60% of all countries will be free. By the turn of the next century, the transition will be complete. Almost every country in the world will be free. We won't have long to wait. Democracy is the wave of the future.
I know we haven't heard from the other side yet, but let's stop things right there. Let's look at the flow of that first argument. I have 3 questions for you as an observer and a judge in the debate. Question 1, what is McFirst's conclusion? Question 2, what is the argument he gives for that conclusion? If there are multiple arguments, what are they? How precisely does his reasoning go? And question 3, did you notice any fallacies going by? If you want to pause and review, go right ahead. So start with question number 1. What is the conclusion of the argument? Here's a good candidate. He said, "What we have witnessed is the increasing democratization of the world." Interestingly, There's also another good candidate for the conclusion. Democracy is the wave of the future. In what you just heard, McFirst tended to run those two together, but they're really separate propositions. One proposition is that more and more countries have become democratic. That's a claim about what we're seeing now. The other is the claim that democracy is the wave of the future, that such a trend will continue into the future. The first proposition is the one he represented with his initial chart. The second proposition is the one he put forward by talking of extending the line. So let's examine the first conclusion. We are witnessing the increasing democratization of the world. What support does he give for that conclusion? What reasons does he give for us to believe it? At the beginning, he just gave us a few vague images. Dictatorships are falling. Monarchies and hereditary aristocracies are tumbling. But then he gave us what he said is hard data. According to Freedom House, free countries, we assume he means democracies, have increased by 20% over the last 35 years. Well, that's not a bad argument, at least if we can trust the data, if we can trust the source. That does make it look like we've seen an increase in democratization. But that was only one conclusion offered in the argument. The other was, democracy is the wave of the future. He represented that by extending the lines into the future. Do we have any additional argument that the observed trend will continue? He says we can project that into the future. If we do, we get his optimistic estimates for worldwide democracy in 2045 and the turn of the next century. Do we really have any further reason to believe that? It doesn't look like it. What about fallacies? Did McFirst use any fallacious sleights of hand? If you said appeal to emotion, I think you're right. It's evident in the emotional language he used. A scent of freedom in the air. Power to the people. The stirring cry of human decency. The sound of democracy on the march. Those just amount to emotional cheerleading for democracy. We may agree that democracy is a wonderful thing, but that doesn't really advance McFirst's conclusion that it's becoming more widespread. Those phrases are just designed to push your emotional buttons. That's just our first bit of debate, and I've already talked longer than Mr. McFirst has. Let's hear what Ms. O'Second has to say in response. In a minute, I'll again be asking you question number one, what conclusion or conclusions are at stake? Question two, what argument or arguments are given? How does the reasoning go? How good are those arguments? And question three, have any fallacies been committed?
I'll give you one thing, Mr. McFirst. We would certainly all like to think that democracy is the wave of the future, but wanting doesn't make it so. I'm afraid I have to challenge your oh-so-rosy and optimistic conclusions. The Arab Spring stirred great hopes in freedom-loving people. But that's because we chose to interpret the Arab Spring in a very particular way. We viewed it as something like an American revolution in the Middle East, down with the dictator, up with human rights and constitutional democracy. I invite you to look at that event more carefully. There were many players in the events of the Arab Spring. And they weren't all advocates of democracy, at least not democracy in the sense we think of it. Whether what we've seen is really a triumph for democracy is something we can't know yet. It is just as likely that the result of those events will not be democracy, but theocracy, governmental control by a religious elite. It is just as likely that the result will not be human rights for everybody, but expanded rights for a few, at the cost of rights for others. It is also very possible that governments set up as a result of those events will be flimsy and fragile, ripe for the takeover by a military junta, or I'm sorry to say, by another dictator. Your one piece of real data, McFirst, is based on a report card published by Freedom House. Much as it claims to be an international organization unaffiliated with any government, surely it's significant that Freedom House is based in Washington, D.C. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government or for the CIA? Let me finally take issue with your future projections. If we do accept the Freedom House data, there is no particular reason to think we can extend your blue line into the future. Let me give you an analogy. In 1971, Gillette introduced the twin razor blade. In 1998, they introduced the first triple blade razor, the Mach 3. Four blade razors appeared between 1998 and 2005 when a five blade razor was introduced. Extend that history in a line like my opponent wants to do, and we'll be seeing hundreds of blades on our razors by 2050. Ridiculous. But that's just like your future projections for democracy. A democracy worldwide, you wish.
Ah, now things are getting a little heated. Let's go to our questions. Well, what were the conclusions? What's the flow of argument, the pattern of reasoning offered? Is her argument valid? Just how good is it? And did you notice any fallacies going by? Press rewind if you want to hear the argument again. Press pause if you want to think about it a minute. Then come back. What is Ms. O'Second's conclusion? That her opponent's wrong, of course. We said that McFirst really had two claims. One, that democracy is increasing in the world, and two, that it's the wave of the future. Which of those was Ms. O'Second attacking? If you said both, you're right. Part of her response was directed at his claim that we've seen democracy increasing. The other part of her response was directed at the claim that democracy is the wave of the future. But she used, importantly, different arguments in those two parts. Try to reconstruct in your mind her argument against the claim that democracy is increasing. Now try to reconstruct what her argument was against the future projection of democracy as the wave of the future. What precisely were those arguments? Take the claim that democracy is increasing. Here, Ms. O'Second really had two arguments. The Arab Spring had been mentioned as a recent sign of increased democratization. Ms. O'Second attempts to throw skeptical cold water on that example. Her argument is that we can't know what we've seen until we see how it eventually pans out. She says, whether what we've seen is really a triumph for democracy is something we can't know yet. Maybe it'll end up in a theocracy, she suggests, in a military junta, or in another dictator. That's a fairly direct challenge to McFirst's claim. Maybe we aren't really seeing an increase in democratization. Maybe we're reading more into it than we really have reason to hope for. How good is that argument? You'll note that it doesn't really prove that McFirst is wrong. It doesn't show that the Arab Spring will result in some non-democratic future. It attacks not so much the claim as McFirst's confidence in it. Maybe we can't yet tell. That's one argument against the democracy is increasing claim, an attack on its certainty. In a second argument, Ms. O'Second attempts to knock down the one data-driven argument that McFirst gives. McFirst relied on Freedom House data. Ms. O'Second attempts to undercut his argument by impugning that source. Remember? Surely it's significant that Freedom House is based in Washington, D.C. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government or for the CIA? That argument doesn't show that the data is wrong. Like the first argument, its goal is to raise doubts. O'Second's arguments, then, are skeptical arguments, intended to raise doubts about the evaluations we tend to make of the Arab Spring, intended to raise doubts about the reliability of Freedom House data. What about her challenge to McFirst's second claim, that democracy is the wave of the future? She attacks that claim even if the first goes through. She says, even if we do accept the Freedom House data, there's no particular reason to think we can extend your blue line into the future. At that point, she uses an argument from analogy, the multiple blade razor analogy. Twin blade razors in 1971, three blades in 1998, four blades by 2005, Extend a linear projection of that history, she says, and we'll see razors with hundreds of blades by 2050. Ridiculous, she says. Just like linear projections for future democratization. How strong an argument by analogy is depends on how strong the analogy is. What's your take on that in this case? I think this particular analogy is probably not particularly good here. At best, it just shows that sometimes we can't project current trends into the future. That doesn't give us any particular reason to believe that this is one of those times. All in all, then, how strong do you think O'Second's response was? If she was out to refute McFirst, I'm afraid she didn't fully succeed. She certainly didn't show his claims to be false. If she was out to raise a few doubts about his confidence, or ours, well, maybe she did succeed at that. What about fallacies? You probably saw at least one. I think there are actually a couple in here, entwined. Both have to do with her attack on Freedom House. McFirst used data from Freedom House. O'Second seems to think we shouldn't accept or rely on that data. Why not? She says, it is surely significant that Freedom House is located in Washington, D.C. That sounds like the ad hominem fallacy. She's implying some kind of underhanded or ulterior motive, an implication that Freedom House is just pushing U.S. policy, perhaps. She's poisoning the well. She adds to that fallacy with an appeal to ignorance. She doesn't really give us any solid reason to think Freedom House should be discredited. She relies instead on leading questions. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government? How do we know it's not just a front for the CIA? Appeal to ignorance. It's Mr. McFirst's turn again. Let's see how he responds. Here again, I want you to try to identify major conclusions. I want you to identify and evaluate patterns of reasoning. And keep an eye out for fallacies.
Well, I guess even democracy has some enemies. It's hard to believe in this day and age that anyone could think that a theocracy or a benevolent dictatorship was preferable to our tradition of individual rights and majority rule. But that seems to be what my opponent is arguing for. I'm the first to admit that the majority isn't always right. That would be the fallacy of appeal to the majority, after all. Allow me to quote a great statesman, Winston Churchill. Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried. When the impact of a policy is spread across the entire population, surely the whole population has a right to decide on that policy. It's not a single individual that has that right. It's not a hereditary aristocracy. It's not a chosen few. It's the people who have the right to decide policy that will govern the people. That's democracy. That's the form of government that is on the rise, however much my opponent may dislike it.
Okay, I'm going to stop the debate right there. That was a really poor response, Mr. McFirst. You disappoint me. You're using rhetorical tricks right out of Schopenhauer's list. The basic problem is this. McFirst isn't arguing against O'Second's real position. Rather than taking on the position that's really on the floor, he's picked an easier position to argue against. By the same token, an easier position to argue for. What McFirst just gave us was almost entirely a straw man argument. At the beginning, you remember, McFirst was arguing that worldwide adoption of democracy was on the rise and would continue. Ms. O'Second challenged his reasons for believing that. This time around, McFirst has charged her with arguing that democracy is not a good thing, that theocracy or benevolent dictatorship would be better. Press replay and you'll find that she never said anything like that. He's attacking a position she never held. He's attacking a straw man, or in this case, maybe a straw woman. By the same token, McFirst is giving himself an easier position to argue for. Not that democracy is historically on the rise, that we can predict that it'll spread, but just that it's a good thing, or as Churchill said, the worst except for all those other forms of government. If we're looking for fallacies, that quote from Churchill might also count as an emotion-loaded appeal to authority. You're using rhetoric rather than appealing to rationality, McFirst. Let's go back and see if you can present a better argument.
Okay, let me try again. Ms. O'Second challenged my first conclusion by casting aspersions on the data from Freedom House. Most of her attack was a fallacious appeal to ignorance. Let me address that directly by reducing some of the ignorance. Freedom House is not an agency of any government. I admit that American foreign policy is a focus and that the organization is based in the United States. Why shouldn't it be? Founded in 1941, it is an advocacy group for political liberty and human rights worldwide. In the 1940s, its target was fascism. In the 50s, communism was its target. Although it took a strong stand against McCarthyism at home. The data I offered comes from an annual survey called Freedom in the World, published each year since 1972. It uses a strategy devised by leading social scientists, based on the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in order to objectively rate every country in the world on indicators for both political rights and civil liberties. Political indicators include electoral process, political pluralism, and lack of corruption. Indicators for civil liberties include freedom of expression and belief, rights of free association, and the rule of law. That's the data that says that the proportion of free countries in the world has risen 20% in the last 35 years. That's the data that says we're witnessing an increase in democracy. As to my second claim, that we can extend that data line into the future, I guess I have to admit that one can't always project current trends directly. But you'll note that Ms. O'Second didn't suggest any forces that might buck that trend. She didn't give any reason to think that the forces that have been driving democratic progress over the last 35 years won't continue. That's my point.
That's a lot better, Mr. McFirst. Now you're focusing on the real points of disagreement, not some made up for a rhetorical effect. You've backed up your data claim for your first conclusion that we've been witnessing increasing democratization worldwide. We might still want to look at the details, but you've certainly countered the appeal to ignorance with real information. I noticed that you've also backpedaled on your second conclusion a bit. Now you've replaced your initial confident claim that the trend will continue with a more modest claim that there's no reason to think it won't. I don't take that as a mark of rhetorical weakness. I take that as a mark of rational strength. Good for you, Mr. McFirst. Let's see how Ms. O'Second responds.
I'm glad that my opponent has seen the light. I am as much an advocate of democracy as he is. Democracy, real democracy, is important. Important things take real work, so democracy is going to take real work. That's why we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that it's easier or more inevitable than it is. Is democracy the wave of the future? That won't be true, I think, unless we work to make it so. We have been raised in a tradition of individual rights that goes back to the American Revolution, including rights to religious freedom. Because of our background, it's hard for us to think of our form of democracy as anything other than the natural form of self-governance. But you have to remember that we got here only by a very specific historical path. Our history was one of Protestant Reformation long before the American Revolution and of colonies physically separating from the mother country. It's not clear that our democracy would have formed without those precedents. It's not clear that it's exportable without such a history. Consider the French Revolution. That too announced the rights of man. But it had a very different outcome. An outcome that led directly to Emperor Napoleon. Other societies don't have the same historical precedents that we did. Democracy with religious freedom as a major component may not come so easily to them. And even when democracy does come in other societies, it may come in a different form. Other societies may become more democratic without adopting a form that ultimately looks very much like our system at all. That's my point.
This may be a little more subtle and a little harder. We want to know, what's the conclusion? What's the intended flow of argument? How solid is the reasoning? And are there any fallacies involved? Did you notice that she began with an Aristotelian syllogism? Right here. Democracy, real democracy, is important. important things take real work, so democracy is going to take real work. Aristotle would be pleased. With that reasoning, she gives her initial challenge a different spin than we saw before. She argued earlier that Offerst's projection into the future was unjustified. Here she says that we shouldn't assume the inevitability of democracy because democratization is going to take real work. What happens in the rest of the argument? Second uses a thumbnail sketch of the American Revolution as the backdrop for another little argument. It starts from the claim that our democracy wouldn't have the form it does without particular aspects of its historical background. The Protestant Reformation, for example, and our existence as colonies. From that, she draws the inference that we should therefore not expect other paths to democracy in other cultures to look like ours. We shouldn't expect the outcome to be the same. How good is that reasoning? Interesting, but I think we have to say it's suggestive rather than a solid proof. She doesn't prove that our institutions demanded those particular historical precedents, nor does she prove that other cultures with other histories couldn't reach the same outcome. If you look at her language carefully, she seems to recognize that this line of thought is merely suggestive. She doesn't really say that our democracy wouldn't have formed without the historical precedents she names. She says it's not clear that it would have. She doesn't say democracy is bound to come in different forms. She said it may. What Osecon has given us in the whole course of the debate, then, are some skeptical doubts and some suggestive counter-suggestions. In urging us not to immediately accept her opponent's stirring forecast of a predictable rise in democratization worldwide, that may be enough. An interesting debate. Not up to the standards of Lincoln and Douglas, perhaps, but a good exercise for analysis. What happened in that other debate? A major topic there was the expansion of slavery into the territories, and by implication, slavery in general. Douglas was clearly on one side. He said, "I believe this government was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever. And I'm in favor of confining citizenship to white men, men of European birth and descent, instead of conferring it upon Negroes, Indians, and other inferior races." There were shouts of encouragement from the audience. Lincoln's position? Quote, "There's no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But at other stops on the debate trail, he says things that are far less inspiring. He says, "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, nor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people." Douglas accused Lincoln of contradicting himself. Lincoln accused Douglas of twisting language so as to make a horse chestnut into a chestnut horse. Debates. Next time, we'll look at another place that rhetoric and fallacies appear, the realm of advertising.